I think members will agree, in general, when the law enforcement agencies do not proceed to charge someone after completing investigations, it is not expected that the agencies go into details of the decision. But if anyone has questions on the decision, the matter can be raised in Parliament, and that is what we are doing now. Now, let me deal with the questions that I have identified. First, the reasons for issuing the stern warning rather than the prosecution, the sufficiency of the DPA and the SOF. Decisions on charging are made by the public prosecutor. In deciding whether to charge, the PP has to consider whether he has the necessary evidence to prove that those individuals were involved in certain conduct and possessed a certain mental state to establish the offences. In this case, as CPIB explained in its media release, there are evidentiary difficulties in doing so. Simply put, there is a lack of sufficient evidence, either documentary or through witnesses, which would establish any criminal charge beyond a reasonable doubt against a specific individual. AGC has made a number of mutual legal assistance requests over 5 years. To date, the findings from these requests are insufficient for prosecution, as I will elaborate later. Given this reality, I would like to know if any member thinks that nevertheless, even without sufficient evidence, the PP should have proceeded to bring charges against individuals who deny the allegations against them. If so, please let me know, and the basis on which you say so. Now, does the fact that KOM had entered into the DPA make a difference in this matter? And would the DPA be enough to at least commence prosecution against the specific individuals in question? The answer is no. The DPA and related documents were entered into between KOM, the US Department of Justice, and the US Attorney's Office. KOM USA, a wholly subsidiary of KOM, also entered into a plea bargain agreement with the US authorities. No individuals were parties to these documents. While the documents make reference to the actions of certain individuals, I have been advised that those references, on their own, are insufficient to establish any offences beyond reasonable doubt without witnesses testifying in Singapore about the context surrounding those actions and the intention behind them. In short, the agencies do not have sufficient evidence that would show beyond reasonable doubt that any of the six individuals were guilty of an offence. CPIB conducted an in-depth investigation within Singapore, within the scope of its legal powers. However, as I said earlier, the difficulty with this case is that several potentially key witnesses are not in Singapore, and CPIB has not been able to secure their cooperation or agreement to testify in Singapore. With the initial assistance of the Brazilian authorities, CPIB made 2 fact-finding trips to Brazil in May and August 2019. AGC and CPIB sent 3 mutual legal assistance, or MLA, requests to Brazil to secure evidence that was needed. AGC and CPIB also sent an MLA request to another relevant foreign authority to interview other potential material witnesses. The contents and outcome of these MLA requests are confidential, but I can inform the House that they have either not yielded evidence that could be used to secure a conviction before our courts, or the responses have not been helpful in advancing the case. There is one foreign witness who gave evidence in other proceedings which could have been relevant in establishing the offences in Singapore. However, that foreign witness is not willing to voluntarily give evidence in Singapore. Neither AGC nor CPIB can compel him to do so. Some members may ask whether any prosecution could be advanced arising out of the fact that a particular individual had entered into a plea bargain in another jurisdiction in relation to his involvement in the KOM bribery. When this individual was investigated by CPIB on his return to Singapore, he denied knowing that commissions paid to the agent in Brazil were paid out as bribes. He did not, during CPIB's investigations, implicate himself or any others in conspiring to pay bribes. Even if the PP applies to a Singapore court to admit the plea agreement, the agreement did not identify any specific individuals and was made in the context of a plea bargain and will be given limited weight without further supporting evidence and in the face of potentially conflicting oral testimony. CPIB has conducted as thorough an investigation as it could with the information and powers that it possessed. However, given the cross-border nature of this case and absence of key witnesses, CPIB's investigations could not overcome the evidential difficulties for the purposes of prosecution in a Singapore court. As such, stern warnings were issued. If subsequently new and compelling facts come to light, it remains open for the PP to re-evaluate the decision in the light of the evolving legal and factual matrix. Ms. Hazel Poir asked whether the decision to issue a stern warning was unanimous in AGC and CPIB, and if other agencies were consulted. Mr. Lewis Chua asked what offences were being considered. The decision not to charge is made by the PP in the exercise of his discretion and professional judgment, taking into account all relevant considerations. The PP does not tell us whether everyone in AGC agreed with him, or if there were differing views, or which agencies he worked with apart from CPIB. Nor is it our task to ask AGC to list all the agencies which were involved. In the end, what matters is the considered view of AGC working with CPIB. In response to Mr. Chua, I'm advised that relevant potential offences were considered by the PP. Next, on the naming of individuals, Mr. Dennis Tan and Mr. Gerald Giam asked about the identities or details of the six individuals. Mr. Murali Pillai and Ms. Sylvia Lim asked whether other entities or persons were involved. As a matter of policy, CPIB does not disclose the names of individuals unless they are charged in court. This policy is not unique to the CPIB. Law enforcement agencies in the US, UK, and New Zealand have a similar approach. The principle underlying this policy is to avoid prejudicing that individual's right to due process and also to avoid any presumption of guilt in the absence of any formal findings. If members feel that hereafter this practice should be changed and that law enforcement agencies should name all individuals who were investigated, even if in the end no charges are brought, then please say so. That would be a major change of policy. But please note, if members want a change, then it cannot only be for this case. It must be for all future cases. And that is something to think carefully about. Members will recall that about 2 years ago, a question was in fact raised in this House, asking about the protections available for those whose reputations are affected by media coverage of ongoing trials of certain offences and how such reports are regulated. Dr. Tam Wu Ming sought statistics on prosecutions and stern warnings, and Ms. Poir asked if warnings were issued in other corruption cases. From 2017 to 2021, CPIB has issued an average of 138 warnings annually, and 139 individuals were prosecuted. Stern warnings are not unusual, being used in cases where there are evidential difficulties or little public interest to prosecute. Questions have been asked on the impact of Singapore's zero tolerance policy on corruption and reputation. There is no change in Singapore's zero tolerance policy in corruption. I have explained the reasons why no criminal proceedings have been brought in this matter. In having regard to the rules of evidence, CPIB and AGC are observing the basic rules for a fair and just criminal justice system. What can be inferred from this is that while Singapore has zero tolerance on corruption, it also strongly adheres to the rule of law. Mr. Murali-Pillay asked in what circumstances CPIB will investigate foreign bribery cases involving Singapore citizens or companies under Section 37 of the PCA. CPIB will investigate all cases, whether they happened locally or overseas, as long as the alleged offences fall under the ambit of the PCA and the information is credible and can be pursued. CPIB will investigate and submit its findings and recommendations to the PP, who will then decide if there is sufficient evidence to prosecute. On Ms. Herting Ruse and Ms. Hazel Poir's questions regarding Singapore companies being convicted of corruption abroad, MFA does not have such records, and CPIB's records do not go as far back as 1965. More recently, in 2015, a Singapore company, Glen Defence Marine Asia Private Limited, or GDMA, pleaded guilty in the USA to bribery-related offences. GDMA was not prosecuted in Singapore, as key evidence against the company was not available here, and GDMA had been dealt with in the USA. However, Gusharan Kaur Sharon Rachel, the Singaporean employee of the US Navy, was prosecuted here as evidence of her corrupt conduct was available to CPIB, and she pleaded guilty to those offences. Mr. Zulkarnain asked if we will amend the PCA to expand the powers of the CPIB to facilitate investigations outside jurisdiction. CPIB's powers under the PCA allow it to investigate offences committed by Singaporeans abroad, but the investigations have to be conducted in Singapore. CPIB cannot conduct investigations abroad, and regardless of what our law says, it is not possible for our agencies to exercise police powers in another country. That would not be allowed or tolerated by any other country, just like we would never allow a foreign investigative agency to exercise police powers in Singapore. Think of it this way. Do you think Singaporeans will or should accept that a regional police force can come into Singapore and interrogate Singaporeans? Hence, when evidence resides outside Singapore, our agencies are dependent on international cooperation and foreign authorities to facilitate their investigations and secure the relevant evidence. This Parliament cannot legislate to empower CPIB to conduct investigations in foreign jurisdictions because that would run afoul of territorial sovereignty. Therefore, members need to be realistic about what we can and cannot do. Singapore companies who operate overseas do so in myriad environments where all kinds of business practices prevail. We cannot police all of them. However, what we can and should do is to insulate our companies and our system against corruption. Our companies must find a way to do business cleanly wherever they do business, and people must know that is how we operate.